How did we get here? Political and cultural polarization in the U.S. President-elect Joe Biden has asked Americans to come together and stop treating opponents as enemies. Is it possible? Was last week's mob insurrection at the U.S. Capitol the outcome of the pent-up anger and divisiveness in our country? Or was it a turning point, shocking people into coming together for a common good? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will discuss the polarization in our country and whether anything can change it. Our guests are two deep thinkers, Mark Hetherington, author of the book Prius or Pickup, How the Answers to Four Simple Questions Explain America's Great Divide, and Judith Rosenbaum, who recently co-edited the book Twitter, The Public Sphere and the Chaos of Online Deliberation. Maine Calling is next. But first, this news. Welcome to Maine Calling. I'm your host, Jennifer Rooks. Why is America so polarized? Is there any hope for change? That's our discussion today. My guest, Mark Hetherington, who is professor of political science at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. He's co-author of the book Prius or Pickup, How the Answers to Four Simple Questions Explain America's Great Divide. And Judith Rosenbaum is associate professor and chair of the Department of Communication and Journalism at the University of Maine in Orono. She co-edited the book Twitter, The Public Sphere and the Chaos of Online Deliberation. We invite your questions or comments about this such important topic. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Mark, you have been studying polarization in this country for some time. What was your reaction to the siege on the Capitol last week?
Oh, Jennifer, it was one of the most dismaying things, probably the most politically dismaying thing that I've ever seen in my life. It was one of those 9/11 types of moments where I think everybody will remember where they were when they came to know that this was going on. And, you know, part of it was, you know, sort of shock and dismay. But then part of it was, well, boy, you know, we have seen this coming for the last several months where, you know, for the first time in history, a sitting president is denying the fact that he actually lost the presidency and is calling on his supporters to come out and support him. So on the one hand, you think, boy, this is something that only happens in other countries, you know, probably third world countries at that. And of course, it comes home to roost in the United States. And on the other hand, it's entirely predictable in this polarized environment where Republicans always seem to follow what Republicans have to say and Democrats in the electorate always follow what Democrats have to say.
Judith, there's been so much fallout from that event and continues to be. But one of the many things is that President Trump was kicked off of Twitter and Facebook. You study Twitter. You've just edited a book about it. Are we at a peak with social media being a part of the polarization in the U.S.?
That's a really good question. And I will try to keep my answer brief. It was definitely an interesting decision to remove Donald Trump from all those various social media sites. It was one that was coming, right? I mean, all of these sites have rules in place, and they warn their users if they're breaking the rules, and then they take action if they continue to do so. For me, I was almost saddened to see that decision being made because, as a researcher, it's been really interesting to see all these various discussions play out. I follow people on all sides of the political aisle on my Twitter and my Facebook, and so for me, it's given me a really good, not complete but almost complete insight into what is going on with in this country, both among Democrats, among Republicans, among independents, and to see the discussions that come out of people disagreeing has been amazing. It's not always pretty, and that's one of the things that the authors in that book write about, is a lot of these discussions are very chaotic, they're ugly, they're not friendly, but I'd rather they take place on social media than, you know, in the streets. Although, as we see, one can lead to the other, like it did last week.
Mm. Can you give us an illustration? I know you're not expecting this, but off the top of your head, something that you saw that really illustrates the larger insight?
Can you clarify what you mean by that?
Well, just maybe a discussion about a topic that was maybe an aha moment for you that says, yeah, this is what I'm seeing. This is encapsulates the differences.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was really interesting when we had people analyze how individuals use Twitter to respond to Black Lives Matter and All Lives Matter, and people would take completely diametrically opposed points of view. They would interpret the protests completely differently. They would use different labels for them. I mean, it was like if you were to follow just, you know, the All Lives Matter supporters, it was like they were watching a completely different series of events unfolding than people who were using the Black Lives Matter hashtag. It's like we were seeing two Americas, but on the same platform. And because they're on the same platform, it's still possible for people who are willing and able to actually observe these conversations on both sides take place in front of you and gain insight into how the various players make sense of what's going on in the world around them.
Sure. So that's part of the reason you were sad to see the decision by Twitter and Facebook, because now you believe one discussion will happen on, for example, Parler, and another discussion on another social media site.
Exactly. So, I mean, I understand, and I'm not arguing that rules are made mostly to be upheld, right? But yes, we are now going to be missing part of that discussion. As more Trump followers take to Parler and take to places like Telegram, those discussions might disappear out of the public eye, which from a research and a sociological perspective is just a loss.
Mark, the premise of your book, Prius or Pickup, is that the polarization we see is due not just to the growing divide between political parties, but in people's very identity. Tell us about what you found in your research.
Well, that's the fundamental of what's going on. One of the things that I think is really important for us to not miss here is that, you know, this is not something that just came out of nowhere, that it's a Donald Trump impact. It's just a strange anomaly in history where, you know, you have this reality TV star who's president. We have a reality TV star who's president because of how the parties have gotten sorted out between Republicans and Democrats. Like, the key thing for us to keep in mind here is that, you know, back when, you know, I'm in my 50s, when I was growing up, the thing that used to divide Republicans and Democrats was a disagreement about how big the government ought to be. You know, should it be, you know, larger, like the Democrats thought, and provide more programs, higher taxes, things like that. And for the Republicans, it was, you know, should the government be smaller, have fewer programs, you know, lower taxes. And those are issues that you can compromise about, you know, a little bit more in the way of taxes, a little bit more in the way of spending, you can meet in the middle. But starting in the 1960s and accelerating through the next several decades, we started to get divided about things that are all about who we are as people, you know, and they're, you know, oftentimes, you know, they're connected to politics, but they're beyond politics. So, you know, when race and then gender rights and then sexual orientation and then immigration and terrorism, all of these things cut much more deeply between Americans. And as a result of that sort of changing divide, you know, no longer is our division about class, but rather about race and gender and sexual orientation, finding a middle ground became harder and harder. And this is the culmination of that process. You know, Donald Trump was a symptom of that type of divide. Republicans decide to embrace somebody who talks as crudely about identity as he does, and the rest is history, as they say.
Judith, I hear you agreeing.
Yes, yes. I'm sitting here nodding. I think that's such a good point. Politics have become more visibly about identity. And one of the things that we saw in the research published in that book, too, is that politics have become a lot more effective. We tend to think about politics as something, you know, cognitive, something we think about and we're logical, but we forget that a lot of politics is very emotional, you know, like race, gender. These are all issues really close to our heart. And then we connect that to the fact that we tend to talk about politics on social media, where social media is used for us to express who we are as a person, right? What car do I drive? What shoes did I buy last week? Where am I going on vacation? Although no one's doing that now. You get the idea. Politics becomes highly personal. It becomes highly effective or highly emotional. And then social media amplify that. And so, like Michael was saying, it's not really a surprise.
I'm wondering, Michael. Go ahead. Yeah.
If I could add just one thing to that, that I think is really important, it is so emotional, but the emotions are all negative emotions as opposed to positive ones. So, you know, one of the things that we find in our research in political science over the years is, you know, as identity has become more important to, you know, what makes us Republicans and Democrats, we don't like our own party any more than we did back when Jimmy Carter was president. The thing that's changed is how much we hate the other party. You know, that is the big change. And, you know, so much of what politics is about these days is, you know, owning the libs or owning the other side in a more sort of general sense. It's not about anything positive. It's about things that are negative.
Right.
Mark, I'm interested. Yeah. Oh, go ahead, Judith.
Sorry, this is just so exciting because I completely agree. And again, that connects back to the idea that we use social media for identity formation and an expression of who we are. And one of the ways in which we express who we are is by making it very clear what we are not. So it becomes a lot more about saying, I don't like you, I don't like that, and I don't like that. But using that as a way to show where you stand.
A lot has been written about, and I'll start with you on this, Mark. A lot has been written about how we're not only on social media dividing ourselves, but physically dividing ourselves. We're living in these islands of groups of people that are like-minded. Increasingly so, we're moving to communities, if we have the ability to move, in which other people think like we do. But what's interesting to me, Mark, is I personally know several people in my lives within sibling groups. There are siblings who are on different sides of this political spectrum and squabble with one another. So it's not completely socioeconomic, is it? And it's not completely, geographic.
Oh, that's a good point. You know, the way that we argue, you know, we use a term, you know, called worldview. You know, it's not socioeconomic. You know, back when, again, we were kids, the main dividing line between the parties was the degree to which socioeconomics in terms of income divided us. So upper income people were Republican, lower income people were Democrats. You know, that dividing line is almost completely gone these days. What that's been replaced by is people who are either upper education or lower education. So socioeconomic status still matters, but it's really all about education as opposed to income. Higher education people on average are Democrats and lower education people are increasingly Republicans. And what this seems to reflect is this sort of difference in worldview. You know, the sort of Democrats tend to, you know, be these sort of more open, outward looking, you know, the world is a playground. You know, I want to have all these new experiences and so forth. And you think about that's what cities provide us with, right? You know, these polyglot places, you know, where you can go to cool restaurants or neat bars or, you know, whatever the cultural activities might be. But then, you know, the Republicans tend to be more traditional, about various different things, more concerned about safety and security and things along those lines. And, you know, liking a certain solidness about the world and not as open to those new experiences. I'm not saying either of these things is better or worse than the others, but going back to one of the things Judith said is, you know, if one party is populated by one type of worldview and the other party is populated by the other type of worldview, you look at the other side and you think, who the heck are those people? I don't get them. I don't know what makes them tick. And as a result, you know, polarization ensues.
Judith, we saw, especially after, we've seen this over the last couple of months a lot, but especially after the mob riots last week, we saw people on social media saying, if you support this side, just unfriend yourself. Tell me about the role of this idea of just like, I'm cutting you off because of your views.
Right. So it you know, and this is also nothing new. I like to tell my students that humans are herding animals. You know, we like to belong to a group, but we especially like to belong to a group that holds the same beliefs we do. As humans, we don't like to suffer from something called cognitive dissonance, where we hold two opposing beliefs at the same time. So if you are a Republican and your best friend's a liberal, now you have a problem, because how can you be best friends with that person? And so we see people responding to that in a variety of ways, right? I'm going to pretend I don't know you're a Republican. And for a long time, people were able to just get away with that. But with politics becoming more front and center and more people talking about it, you can no longer take that tactic. So now instead, you have to either mute that person to where you don't see what they're saying, or tell them, just please, you know, leave my friend's group. I'm not going to talk to you anymore. We knew this was a thing even with traditional mainstream media, where people would just engage in what we call selective exposure. They just wouldn't watch or read things they didn't agree with. Nowadays, we just mute certain friends or unfollow them or unfriend them altogether. And it's just part of our human nature, in that we like to exist in a world where all the pieces fall into place and everything makes sense.
Mark, is this unchangeable? Is this just where we are?
Let me tag on to something that Judith points out, and then go forward with that towards, is this, you know, anything that we can do anything about? So again, just to go back in time, you know, because Judith's exactly right. I mean, you know, it's very difficult for us to you know, admit that we're friends with somebody on the other side, and one of the reasons, and that is in our own mind. We have a hard time admitting that in our own mind. And here's the thing, you know, back in the 60s and 50s and 40s, you know, if we disagreed with a Republican, if we were a Democrat or vice versa, it was about, should we tax more or spend more? I mean, who cares? We don't even understand, you know, those types of things. But now, if we are, you know, consorting with somebody on the other side of the political aisle, it's about, does that person care about racial equality or gender equality or LGBT rights? And there's so much more at stake, you know, when it comes to stuff like that. You know, my view is, you know, in going forward, this is a very difficult thing for us to get out of unless the questions that divide Republicans from Democrats change. You know, unless we go back to sort of a more class-based disagreement, you know, if we have these sort of race and sexual orientation and gender-based divides, you know, it's very difficult to look at the other side and say, oh, I get you. I understand you, because we don't. We see the world in such fundamentally different ways.
Judith, is there any way to change?
Yeah, I'm a little Pollyanna optimistic person. One way I think we can change it is to get out of our echo chambers, right? The algorithms on social media, they create this filter bubble where we exist in a world where all we see is opinions and worldviews that echo ours. I believe that instead we should mindfully expose ourselves and obviously expose ourselves to other points of view. So if you love MSNBC, go watch Fox, go watch OANN, you know, watch the other side. Talk to people who disagree with you and ask them, why do you think X? Why do you think Y? And that requires effort, and that's uncomfortable, but nobody ever said democracy was going to be easy.
Well, the only downside, of course, you know, in that direction is, you know, imagine taking a liberal and putting that person down in front of OANN or Newsmax.
Mark, will you tell us what OANN is?
Oh, it's a cable news channel for conservatives. It's One American News. It's Donald Trump's now favorite news outlet.
Okay.
And it is out there. And if, you know, again, one of the things that happens if you take, you know, people, you put a liberal in front of Fox News or OANN or a conservative in front of MSNBC, is they get really angry because the things that they're seeing and hearing are not, you know, consistent with their understanding of how the world works. And it actually has the potential, at least, to exacerbate the problem. You come to realize, man, these people are even worse than I thought. As opposed to looking at them and saying, oh, okay, well, I understand their perspective. Right now, I imagine if you turned on OANN, what you would be seeing is, things about how Antifa was actually behind the storming of the Capitol. That seems to be all over right-wing social media. And, you know, for a liberal, that's not going to help you understand. That's just going to, you know, make you even madder, than you were before. So anyway, finding that middle ground is just super difficult these days. It seems like we ought to be able to, get together in the middle about some of these things. But again, our understanding of the world is so different. And our, as Judith is getting at, even our understanding of facts is so different that, being exposed to the other side's facts is, I think, less likely to make people understanding and more likely to be like, oh, my God, really?
Mark, this is such a great discussion, Judith, but we need to go to a quick break. I promise it's a quick break. We're going to continue this discussion about partisanship and the divide, the great divide in America right now. We'll be right back. This is Maine Calling.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Evergreen Home Performance, dedicated to helping homeowners qualify for Efficiency Maine insulation rebates and loans. More at evergreenyourhome.com.
On the next Fresh Air, humorist Fran Lebowitz. After developing a now famous case of writer's block, she turned talking into an art form. She's now in the new Netflix documentary series called Pretend It's a City. It's a series of interviews with her, conducted mostly by her friend Martin Scorsese, who also directed the series. Join us.
Tonight at 8 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. Join us this evening on Maine Public Television as we discover the fascinating story of Elizabeth Smith Friedman, the groundbreaking cryptanalyst who helped bring down Al Capone and break up a Nazi spy ring in South America. Her work helped lay the foundation for modern code breaking. American Experience presents The Codebreaker this evening at 9 on Maine Public Television.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We are talking about how America became so divided and whether there's hope for the nation to unite and heal. My guest, Judith Rosenbaum, associate professor with UMaine's Department of Communication and Journalism. Her research focuses on social media's effects on society. And Mark Hetherington, professor of political science at the University of North Carolina. He was formerly at Bowdoin. His research focuses on the polarization of public opinion. Share your comments or questions via email, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. So many calls and comments coming in, but before we get to that, I want to quickly ask each of you, and I'll start with you, Mark Hetherington. The president-elect, Joe Biden, is really continuing to pound a message of unification. He's calling on plain, simple decency as being the value that will unite us. I've heard some skepticism coming from you about whether we can be united. What do you think about Biden's message?
Oh, I love Biden's message. You know, one of the things that's, you know, one of the most frustrating parts about being a person who studies public opinion is you learn that everything that you thought you knew growing up is wrong. So, you know, we grow up thinking that, you know, the opinions of ordinary people, you know, inform the things that the people who govern us do. You know, so in other words, that it's a bottom-up process. Ordinary people, you know, sort of push elected officials to do what we are bidding. But what really is at work is that because we don't care very much for the most part as people, what we do is follow our political leaders. We take cues from them. And it points up just how important they are to how we as ordinary people respond to politics. And so it's very, very important that we have leaders that are providing that type of cue, that type of understanding that we ought to be decent, that we ought to try to find common ground. And that's what Joe Biden is doing. And hopefully that will start to, you know, have an impact. How big of an impact is the thing that I am a little bit skeptical of.
Judith.
Yeah, it's really interesting that that Mark brought that up, but because I was just reading a study the other day where it showed that networks where we have a very strong leader, like a political leader, tend to be more polarized because the leaders tend to espouse more partisan opinions. So when a political leader espouses a more moderate opinion, his or her network will more likely follow, and so we will see less polarization as a result.
We'll go to Nate, who's calling from West Bath. Hi, Nate. Go ahead.
I think I can start out with saying I got a 23-year-old daughter, and I never let her have the technology. And at the end of her senior year, she thanked me in a thesis paper in her English class. I think one of the biggest things to take away from this whole thing is technology is a great divider because, A, once you see things, you can't unsee them. Once you hear things, you can't unhear them. And once you become, like, without a better way to put it, titillized, you become what you want to, what you enjoy. And the scariest thing about this is the note passing without supervision, just the whole idea behind some of these platforms allows the magnification of ideas and beliefs. And so we become greater and greater segregated, by this technology. And it's putting us in a very bad position.
Sure, Nate. And I'm going to read an email from somebody who agrees with you. This is from Don. He writes, I see social media as the direct cause of what happened on January 6th. With no verification of facts and ideas, myriad conspiracies can easily snowball into real movements and the resulting polarization. I am old enough to remember many presidential elections, all with peaceful transitions. Then the internet brought totally unregulated social media. That's an extremely powerful tool for insurrection. Judith, we were all many in the Western world were celebrating social media when it came to the Arab Spring. But now people are blaming social media for what happened last week at the Capitol.
Absolutely. And I mean, I agree. Technology magnifies everything, right? But at the same time, I'm also a firm believer in that ultimately it's individuals who make the decisions, right? Technology is a platform. It's a tool that, when used by the right people, can lead to really good developments. When used by the wrong people, it can lead to really bad things. And we do see, though, that places like Twitter have started to recognize their influence. Like, they've started to label information as being incorrect. They've taken tweets down that are clearly not correct either. So we do take these platforms, taking some responsibility for the content on them, which I do see as a good thing. But I do want to caution for a deterministic approach, because ultimately it's the humans who make these decisions. We take in this information and interpret it in a certain way. But that's one perspective.
Mark?
Mark? I could not agree more. I mean, that is such a good point. Whether it's social media or whether it's ideological news stations, they magnify. They don't create. You know, they magnify. There's an audience, that the reason that they exist is to make money. And to make money, there must be an audience out there that wants to do this. So don't take the focus, the responsibility away from ordinary people. And, you know, because they're the people who are making these decisions. You know, social media is magnifying these things. And the last thing that I want to point up from the email is, you know, there are a lot of reasons that we have never had a problem like we're having right now with a peaceful transition of power. And that's because no president other than Donald Trump has ever questioned, whether they lost an election in the way that he has. And he has, of course, no reason for doing that except for to stir up trouble. Again, it's an individual's decision in this case. It's not social media. Social media is just amplifying what the president has done. But it's the president's actions that are the ones that we ought to be concerned about.
Nate, thank you so much. Yeah, sorry. Go ahead, Judith.
I was going to say, and ultimately, you know, the show is about, can we change this? We can, but we got to take responsibility, right? And we can't shift blame to a platform.
Good point. Nate, thank you. Beth on Facebook writes, how do we find middle ground with people carrying Confederate flags or wearing Nazi symbols? At what point do we realize that some things move beyond, quote, opposing views or politics and into the realm of significant harm to other citizens and to our democracy? This show is a bit mild in the wake of a literal storming of our Capitol by one side. Mark?
Oh, I couldn't agree more. You know, it's very important for us to keep in mind that there are just some people who you're not going to reach, you know, who are not going to be part of moving forward, who are not going to be part of the middle ground. You know, you're just not going to be able to deal with that, you know, 10 or 15 or whatever percent of people that are out there carrying Confederate flags and so forth. But, you know, the thing that's really important to keep in mind in thinking about this is that 10 or 15% of people is always out there in the United mm-hmm. States. Mm-hmm. The key thing is that they're not always they're not always relevant. In fact, they're almost always marginal. And it's really up to political leaders right now to marginalize those people. It's really important for the Mitch McConnells of this world and the Kevin McCarthy's, the minority leader of the House, to marginalize that movement and to say, look, you know, we do not have any connection to those extreme ideas, to marginalize these people that, you know, are such a public part of Trump's base. And if they're not willing to do that, if the modern day Republicans are not willing to do that because they're afraid they're going to lose their votes, the votes of those people, then we have a real problem. But, you know, if they have the courage to marginalize those voices back to where they used to be, you know, in their basements or wherever, then we have a chance going forward. But it's going to take a lot of political courage on the political right to make that happen. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Judith, thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there is a line. There's obviously a line. And I think that Mark made a really important point, is these people have always been around. Confederate flags are nothing new, unfortunately, and neither are Nazi symbols. What happens with social media is it renders these groups more visible, right? It gives them a space to connect with each other and to make themselves heard to the wider audience who might have until that point been unaware that there were so many people who supported these ideas.
We'll go to Peter calling from Lovell. Hi, Peter. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm on the air.
Yes, go ahead.
Hi, first-time caller. This is a wonderful discussion. I wanted to, frame myself in the terms of the identity politics discussion and give a commentary that's very personal about the other day. So I am just moved to Maine. I'm a physician, white, male, cishet, liberal upbringing. I went to Amherst College. I worked for Harvard Medical. I love LGBTQ rights. I voted for Biden. I'm watching this, and the discussion today is so interesting, and I worry about how, naive we are being about the danger we're facing ahead of us right now. The identity politics that have been, you know, discussed by the commentators that have divided this country so starkly and so broadly, you know, even split, 775 million and 80 million left and right. Social media has become the most dangerous thing I think we've ever faced. I saw on the TV during the insurrection a classmate of mine who was, while he was at Amherst, a drama major. He's gay. He had the most wonderful time there, completely liberal, lauded, graduated magna cum laude, and he has become, over the past couple months, I've come to learn, radicalized, to the point where he was somehow on the platform next to that guy with the horns on his head that everyone saw.
Oh.
you know, in the halls of Congress.
Yeah, Peter, I want to return to the point you were making earlier about the danger. And Mark, I think that that is a worry of so many people, that it's all fine and well to talk about coming together and understanding our background. But a lot of people feel real fear right now, real fear about the fact that there are so many guns in America. And many of the people who are angry own those guns. And they're angry that there were people who are at the U.S. Capitol with tasers and weapons. What do you say to those people who say, are we being naive if we're just talking about this sort of in a philosophical way?
Yeah, I think there's plenty to be worried about, actually. I'm concerned about it, too. I mean, imagine those election officials in Georgia who refused to bend to the pressure that they were receiving from President Trump and Lindsey Graham to change the votes there. You know, they were under constant threats. You know, their wives were under constant threats for their lives from who knows who these folks are, but you have a sense that they're, you know, heavily armed and so forth. How to lower the temperature here, again, is going to be an issue that our political leaders are going to have to take on. You know, Joe Biden, of course, is doing this on the political left, saying, you know, it's time for, you know, decency and taking down the temperature a little bit. The political right is going to need to do that, too, and send messages mm-hmm. to their side and just disavow, you know, this type of behavior and marginalize these groups. If that doesn't happen, we're going to continue to have plenty to be worried about.
And Judith, what about Peter's point that social media is the worst thing to happen ever?
So first, I want to echo what Mark just said, is this is a very scary time to live in. I completely share Peter's sentiment. I mean, I'm very afraid as well for the future for this country. At the same time, are social media the worst thing to have ever happened? I don't know. I mean, I completely recognize that they render these groups visible, which prior to social media, like Mark said earlier, were restricted to someone's basement, right? Or rallies in a cornfield somewhere, and not for everyone to join, right? I mean, apps like Telegram and Parler do definitely allow neo-Nazis, white supremacists to find each other and to feed off of each other, further increasing polarization and their popularity. That is a problem. At the same time, I think we got to still realize this is also human nature. You know, to say social media is the worst thing that's ever happened is also to denounce all the other good things that have come out of it, like Black Lives Matter, like the Arab Spring, like the Me Too movement. Right. So I think it's important to acknowledge that as well.
Peter, thanks for your call. We are going to take another quick break. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from AARP Maine, advocating on the issues that matter to Mainers over 50 and their families. AARP.org/ME.
I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. Democrats and even some Republicans are calling for President Trump's removal from office after the attack on the Capitol.
Also, the number of deaths from COVID-19 continue to rise to the highest level since the outbreak began. That's next time on Here and Now.
Coming up shortly after Maine Calling at 12 noon here on Maine Public Radio. There will be a Maine CDC briefing with Dr. Nirav Shah this afternoon at 2 o'clock. The briefings are currently on a Monday, Wednesday, and Friday schedule. Tune in to Maine Public Radio, Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, or the Maine Public Facebook page at 2 this afternoon for the live update. The CDC briefings are also archived on our website for later on-demand viewing. You can find the link on the television drop-down at MainePublic.org. Once again, the Maine CDC briefing on the coronavirus today at 2 on Maine Public Radio, Maine Public Television, MainePublic.org, and on Facebook.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and we are on Maine Calling. Today on our program, what makes us so divided as a nation? And what's the future? Joining me, Mark Hetherington with the Department of Political Science at UNC and Judith Rosenbaum with the Department of Communication and Journalism at UMaine Orono. If you'd like to join our conversation, our number is 1-800-399-3566. We're going to go to Lori calling from Harpswell. Hi, Lori. Go ahead.
Yes. The reason I called was to Judith's point earlier on how to sort of connect with the other side. And I was telling your producer that you know, I'm a liberal, but most of our family here is conservative. And my dad pointed me to Real Clear Politics. And it, to me, I can't turn on Fox News and watch for more than a few minutes. It just is so insightful, the cable news network. So I like to read Real Clear Politics because they give articles from the left, articles from the right, articles, you know, from the Atlantic to the Federalist to all different points of view. But more recently, I do want to comment. Our family, there are people in our family that are well-educated that have become radicalized through social media. And their language has changed, and our dynamics have changed. And I've actually gotten off Facebook for that very reason. It's scary. It really is scary. And I don't know how to address because at one point I posted a chart that Google had put out on, you know, news centers and news media and what is left and what is right and what is center. And then I got pushback from the radicalized family members saying, oh, Google is left and Google is, you know, part of that high tech machinery that's against Donald Trump. So it's just, you know, how do we do that? How do we, you know, but that was my comment as far as if people want to dip their toe into the other side, that's been a good source for me.
Thank you, Lori, for that. Judith, thoughts?
Yes. So I think the chart that Lori's talking about is the media bias chart, which I've actually used when teaching about media literacy. For people who don't know it, you can Google it, assuming you trust Google. And it's a very reliable chart. You can also use this wonderful website that I have my students use called allsides.com, which shows you how a particular story is presented from the center, the left, and the right. As far as responding to people who say you can't trust Google, right, and I've run into this, both my husband and I have run into this on Facebook, actually, is, and this might be the social scientist in me, is I ask them, why is that? Can you show me your sources? So I try to remove myself from the conversation completely, and I just ask them to tell me, where did you get this from? What do you base this on? To see if I can somehow reason with them. You know, to make them see that, okay, maybe you're a bit off base here. And you know that we may not be able to change how they respond, but we can change how we respond, which is a lot to put on an individual because you're sitting there going, what is going on? Why would you say Google's unreliable? You know, you want to get worked up and mad. I think if we can stay calm and just ask them to explain, ask them to come up with sources and counter sources, but do this from a place of friendship, one might be able to make a difference. Again, I think my nickname is Pollyanna, so I'm happy if Mark wants to disagree with me on this.
Well, also, and I know, Mark, that one of your points that you have made over and over is to not make assumptions about other people's motives in believing what they believe.
Yeah, and I think this is really important. You know, to understand why people, really understanding, you know, what makes people conservative or what makes people liberal, you know, might be, you know, a very useful thing. You know, some of these issues that divide us, you know, have to do, you know, with real fundamentals of life, you know, how secure we feel, you know. So, you know, it seems that, you know, liberals are, you know, less likely to think that the world is a super dangerous place. And so, you know, things like guns and anti-immigration policies and, you know, things along those lines are you know, less important. If you are on the political right, you think, well, you know, if you don't have staunch immigration policies to keep, you know, people out of the country, you know, you're leaving us open to danger. And understanding that is probably, you know, in some way useful. But the bottom line is, you know, and this is what's so dismaying, I finding a middle ground on these types of things when our worldviews are so opposed to each other, I'm pretty negative about, I mean, at least in terms of how effectual, you know, it will be. So I don't know if you guys have had any experience. It sounds like, you know, Judith has in trying to, you know, sort of engage with people and, you know, help yourself understand how they are. When I've done that, and I've been doing this a lot, you know, on social media, when I, you know, start to ask those types of questions, you know, the response that I tend to get is something like, shut up, libtard. You know, it's not like, you know, nobody's taking, you know, these things seriously, these efforts at engagement seriously. And it's because there's just so much emotion you know, that's tied up in this. As Judith was talking about, you know, we could have a cognitive, you know, in our heads understanding about what's going on in politics, or an in your guts, you know, affective feeling based politics. And what we have is the latter. And, you know, you try to reason with people, you know, when it comes to, you know, feelings, it's you know, it's just going to be frustrating, you know, when you get right down to it. And, you know, again, what we need is political leaders, maybe a new generation of political leaders. I always, you know, sort of try to inspire my students, you know, not to, you know, fall away from politics, but rather to get involved in politics and change, you know, the way you know, the political system works, because if it's, you know, left in the same hands, same cynical hands that we have right now among our leaders, it's just going to keep replicating this. It's human nature for us to rely on our emotions rather than our brains right now.
Lori, thanks so much for your call. Moving up to Orono and Dennis. Hi, Dennis. Go ahead. Dennis, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to ask Mark a question in reference to some of the other statements you've made about the difficulty in getting and engaging people. And I've personally tried to reach out to several of my friends who I believe are Trump supporters but would not support the things that happened at the Capitol in the recent past. And I have not been able to get even them to engage with me. And I'm wondering if you think the events at the Capitol recently will have eventually, as the Republican GOP start to switch away from Trump, do you think the society will follow and that will open up doors for us to have more conversations?
Dennis, I'm so glad you asked that question. I think a lot of people have that question, Mark, wondering if what happened last week will shock some people into believing differently, or are you skeptical about that?
Oh, I think it has great possibilities. You know, and again, this is one of the things where, you know, again, the leadership is important. The opinion leadership is important. And a lot of Republican leaders have completely repudiated what happened at the Capitol, whether it is, you know, Senator Toomey from Pennsylvania or Majority Leader McConnell from Kentucky. You know, a wide swath of Republicans are like, this is too much. You know, we can't have this any longer. And interestingly, about half of Republicans in recent polls have said, you know, that was a bridge too far. You know, about 45% of Republicans want nothing to do with that siege. Now, you might, you know, think about things like, well, what about that other 55% who seems to think it's okay? And that is a real big concern. I don't mean to suggest otherwise. But my sense is that as more and more revelations come out about how horrible the situation was and what the president did to stoke it, leaders will continue to take positions against it. That is Republican leaders. And Republicans in the electorate will think, ah, man, we really blew that one. But again, keep in mind with the supporters, the Republican supporters, it's very hard to admit a mistake when you hate the other side. You know, so think about this. I mean, you know, you guys sound really nice. You probably don't hate anybody. I do. And, you know, I have a really hard time seeing anything that is consistent with their point of view. All right. So there are a lot of Republicans out there, and maybe they don't even love Donald Trump, but they really don't want to admit that the Democrats were right about him. And that's going to be a big challenge for us to overcome.
Judith?
Yeah, and I wanted to add on to that, that it's important to keep in mind that the media, you know, Maine Public included, you know, you need to make money. And one way that a lot of mainstream media make money is to magnify the loudest voices. The loudest voices are usually not the ones in the center saying, all right, y'all, let's calm down a little bit. It's the extreme ones, right? The ones who continue to say that what happened at the Capitol was fine or it was Antifa or whatever. And I think that a little bit of media literacy on our part to realize, okay, the reason we're still hearing these people is because that's what's drawing in eyeballs and that's what's drawing in advertising dollars. That might not reflect how the entire Republican Party feels about something just because it's in the news.
Sure. We do have a different model on public radio, and I don't want to do a whole show about that. But for example, there's no advertising. But Dennis,
that's
thank
right.
you for your call. I'm going to go to Jean calling from Poland. Hi, Jean. Go ahead.
Hi. Sorry, I'm trying to turn off my radio. I wanted to call because I'll declare myself here. I'm a highly educated Prius driver with all the attitudes that Mark would predict from that. Okay. But I'm not on Twitter, but I do use Facebook. And one of the things I have done, I think that one of the things that's pernicious about the echo chamber of Facebook is that you get the most likes when you use the most outraged emotional language and images. And so one of the things I have tried to do is to challenge my friends on the left to lower the volume, to lower the temperature by saying, okay, what evidence do you have to support this particular outraged language? And why are you using this image? I went and looked, and this, you know, vote that you claim happened didn't happen. So I try to challenge the people who agree with me to lower the temperature and lower the volume. And that's one of the strategies I've used. I'm not sure how effective it is, but it's a way I've tried to personally lower the volume.
Judith, what do you think of Jean's strategy?
I think it's an excellent strategy. I mean, the way social media works is they have these algorithms that they use to predict what everybody will like. And people, unfortunately, tend to like sensationalist stuff. We like images. We like, you know, huge claims. I mean, when the storming at the Capitol happened, I just literally posted, y'all know, and it got so many comments, and I went, really? So I kind of like that challenge. If we all tone it down a little bit, then maybe the algorithms will shift, and maybe the rhetoric will calm down. I actually really like that.
Jean, thanks for your call. I'm going to try to squeeze in an email from Denise because it's an interesting question. She writes, I often wonder what the role of pundits has had in this polarization. I remember growing up when the news was the news, delivered in a nonpartisan manner by a voice of reason. We all watched the same news, but the rise of pundits seemed to be correlated to the rise in polarity. I remember when my mother and father-in-law started listening to Rush Limbaugh and immediately drew out arguments and differences in our family gatherings. They are Democratic or Republican-leaning voices on all the news programs. Mark, we have about a minute left.
I'll do my best. This is right. The idea that you know, again, as I've been talking about throughout the show, this sort of top-down nature of our public opinion, you know, if our opinion leaders are really polarized, then we're going to reflect that polarization. It was probably those beliefs and those feelings were probably always there, you know, to some degree, especially when it came to race and gender and sexual orientation. But there was no Rush Limbaugh back in that golden age of television news when Walter Cronkite ruled the day to bring those worst instincts that people have out. But the thing is, they were always there. Conservative talk radio at first and then Fox News later knew it was there. They drew it out. They made a whole lot of money based on it. And as a result, you know, we have what we have. And the left, of course, has responded in kind. And so we have that same level of emotion on both sides of the political aisle. But again, the key thing is, you know, these emotions, these feelings, these beliefs that we have, they've always been there. And it's the pundits and it's the politicians that are bringing out our worst instincts.
All right. Well, that's going to have to be our last word. You all were fantastic guests. So much to think about. Mark Hetherington, political science professor at the University of North Carolina. He co-authored the book, Prius or Pickup, How the Answers to Four Simple Questions Explain America's Great Divide. And Judith Rosenbaum from UMaine, she co-edited the book, Twitter, the Public Sphere and the Chaos of Online Deliberation. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.
Next time on The World, the sheer number of deaths from COVID-19 is causing many people to go numb. Psychologists have a phrase for that.
The more who die, the less we care when we're relying on our feelings. And that is a perverse arithmetic that we have to recognize in order to overcome that.
Combating COVID apathy. It's on The World.
Join us this afternoon at 3 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
For black farmers in this economy, racism manifests in a whole lot of ways. One of them, pricing.
They know they're getting less for their crops than their white neighbor down the street getting for his crop.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. From crop prices to land loss, systemic racism in agriculture. Next time on Marketplace.
Coming up this evening at 6:30, right here on Maine Public Radio. In Maine, weather this afternoon, increasing clouds, highs 27 to 40 from north to south. Tonight, mostly cloudy, some snow showers in the north and mountains, up to an inch for some. Lows will be in the teens for most, lower 20s along the coast. Tomorrow, partly cloudy in the north and mountains, mostly sunny for the rest of the state, with highs 28 to 41 north to south. This is listener-supported Maine Public Radio, WMEH Bangor 90.9, WMEA Portland 90.1, WMEP Camden 90.5, WMEM Presque Isle 106.1, WMED Calais 89.7, WMEW Waterville 91.3, WMEF Fort Kent 106.5, on the web at mainepublic.org. Here and Now is coming up next. Here Now is made possible by Maine Public Radio listener contributions and by Lee Auto Malls, family-owned and operated since 1936, with locations from Bangor to Saco.